Again, the topic of this workshop is the triangle of self-obsession, and our first speaker is going to be Mike V.
Thank you. I'm an addict. My name's Mike. And this is great. This is fun. I love talking about Narcotics Anonymous and what Narcotics Anonymous has done for me in my life. And the really, really good news is that like almost anybody that I've met in Narcotics Anonymous, they have two favorite IPs, and most of them, and it's the triangle of self-obsession or self-acceptance. And like most other people, those were mine also. And for a number of years, obviously, I identified with the first part of that IP, the problems. And gradually, over time, I don't know, you know, exactly when it happened, but thinking about this, because of you guys and this program and the steps, I don't automatically go to the fear and the anger and the resentment when I think of this piece. I identify, as time goes on, more and more and more with the solution part of this piece, the love, the faith, and the acceptance. And I am not at all the same human being I was when I walked in here. And I was as self-centered as anybody else. And it was devastating to me when I did my first sixth step and then seventh step, just how totally and absolutely self-centered I was. It was really like, I had been to a bunch of meetings by that time and obviously had worked the previous steps. And so I had a grasp or an understanding of self-centeredness. But when I got there, it was devastating how all-consuming my self-centeredness was. I don't know that I knew what love was. And again, because of you guys, I had Ivan Fask was my sponsor for a number of years, and he passed away, I'm guessing, I'm not real good with timelines, I'm guessing about 3 years ago. And, you know, you develop this relationship and you're in each other's lives and everything, and he had such a peace and a love about him. And I don't remember ever sensing one bit of judgment from that man. And when he passed, I know about parents loving children and children loving parents and brothers loving sisters and so on and those kinds of loves and everything. But I honestly didn't know that you could love another human being like I loved that man. I was aware of it during the process, and so I made sure I told him that I loved him, and I had for years and years. But after he passed, at the depth of that, I didn't know it was possible. I really didn't. And those were foreign things to me. And so I am not a stepologist, but I work the steps. You know, in that our newer piece, the Living Clean, there's actually a section in there that talks about, it describes it. There's a section dedicated to it, and then there's several other parts in that piece where they refer back to it. And it talks about this transformation we go through, this transition of when we come crawling in here at the end of the road, and our recovery is motivated by desperation. We even call it the gift of desperation, which was a ridiculous sentence when I got here. I don't know. You guys are sick. And so it talks about this transformation going to recovery being motivated by passion. Okay? And I have just fell in love with this. with this fellowship and what we do here and why we do it. And my recovery is motivated by passion. And I have a passion to become a better human being and just continue on this path and stay engaged in this process. And my life is a success by any barometer you would like to use. I ended up in the medical field. When I got clean, I was 34 years old, and I had never been on a job interview, right? And so I knew like where five veins were. That was the extent of my anatomical knowledge. And so because of you guys and what you taught me here, I ended up with my own medical practice. And I ended up seeing my father as a patient whom, during active addiction, his business basically went in my arm, right? And so, by any barometer, you know, I'm married to the most incredible woman I've ever met, socially, financially, where I live, whatever. By any barometer, I am a success. There is nothing in my life that is as fulfilling, as enriching as this. Nothing. When I have the opportunity to be of service and I'm in that moment and I'm trying to welcome somebody and trying to get them to maybe come back tomorrow, it's like my faith has, I had none. But what has happened for me is in that moment when I'm doing that, it's not like a week later that I look back on it and say, wow, that was a God thing. As time's gone on, in the moment, I can appreciate it, and I can welcome my higher power into that moment, and I can embrace that. And so, for years and years and years, that saying, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, that was always about me and my miracle. Always. And sometime, and I don't know when, it's changed into, I don't want to leave 5 minutes before your miracle. And if I go around saying you guys saved my life and created a miracle in my life, and I'm doing for other people what you guys have done for me, then I'm participating in some way, shape, or form in a miracle. I just am. And it felt real weird and egotistical to embrace that, but that's what I call that false humility, where I wouldn't accept compliments or accept really good things about myself. But I embrace that today. I encourage that today. And so, I'm not the same human being. So I started the steps again several months ago. And Barry suggested that, because I did them, you know, I got clean in 89, and I've done them a number of different ways. A number of different ways over the years. And he suggested that I do it just what the step means to me today. Just right here and right now. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I'm up to 10 or 11 now. But the first step, so I didn't write really anything about powerlessness or unmanageability. You know, when you come in here and you got court dates and you haven't never worked in your life and you got no job and no license, no car and three lawsuits against you and, you know, life's not, the unmanageability is really, really, really easy. And the powerlessness is very, very easy. You know, you're homeless, you've given everything to the disease of addiction, right? Those are really easy things. And, so what came to me as I was writing what the first step means to me today is it was all about the disease. It was all about addiction that we're powerless over. And I did, you know, I went to all three of the books that I was using, It Works, The Text, and The Living Clean, and got to the core of the disease, which it says is self-centeredness, which it says in another piece, it calls it our raging self-obsession, our raging self-obsession. And I wrote about that. And then as I'm writing about it, it's crystal clear to me that I am not that person. I'm not saying I'm cured, that I don't have self-centeredness in my life and it doesn't creep in, but it doesn't rule my life like it used to. And I'm feeling really, really good about me and my recovery as I got further into that step. the raging self-obsession. And so as I've gone through this process, sometimes I think of others before I think about myself. And it used to be I had a practice at it, that somebody's going through something, so the right thing to do is to call them or to go visit them or to do this or to that. But it was a thought process. It was a process that the right thing to do is this. And sometimes, I'm happy to say, fairly often, it just happens. I realize it afterwards. It's not that I have to go through that thought process that, well, I should call Paul. He's going through something, or I should do this, or and it just I just do it, you know, and I embrace that, and it's just like I said, the most fulfilling thing in my life, and the things that I find fulfilling today are amazing to me. And so when I was in detox and I just got out of detox and was in treatment, I guess, and I became aware of that fear. And like a lot of us, in active addiction, I was in some dangerous situations with some dangerous people that somebody on the outside might think I had something, you know, some kind of courage or something, some kind of bravado or something. But the reality is I was really, really high and really, really stupid. And I was in some dangerous situations, right? But I got, you know, a couple weeks out of detox and that fear hits me. And I realize that it's been there for as long as I can remember. And that uneasiness. And I wasn't happy with who I was. At whatever age, whatever self-awareness comes, I don't know. Whatever age that comes, I wasn't happy with what I was becoming self-aware of. Right? And it was all fear-based. And so for me, my understanding, when I got high, of course I fell in love with it. I was predisposed to it all along. And so with the other side of that, after having come aware of that, today I refuse. When I'm making a decision and I'm getting to a point in my life, and I become aware that the final factor, the final thing hanging there is fear, I refuse to allow fear to make that decision for me. I absolutely refuse for that to be the deciding factor. It's repulsive to me. When going through this process and getting that full awareness of that fear and how it played a part in my life all those years. And so, the two best, for me, vivid examples of both parts of that piece are a couple of sponsees that I had for like 25 years or so. And they're both gone now. Barry, I sponsored him since he got here until he passed, like around 25 years. And, you know, I was in his wedding. His daughter gave birth to twins and one of them passed. I was there, you know. We've become involved in each other's lives. And I saw how he guided his family through tragedies and this and that and everything. And he got cancer and it hit hard and he lasted about 8 weeks. And I kept waiting. I talked to him every day or saw him every day through this process. And I kept waiting for anger, resentment, and fear. I was looking for it because he always mentioned blessings or blessed and gratitude in every conversation. You know, and after a couple weeks of it, I noticed everyone, he's like, talking about blessings and gratitude. And it went on for, like I said, 6 or 8 weeks, and I never heard the resentment, the anger, or the fear. It just never, ever came. And so the phone rang one day, and he got the caller ID, and I said, hello. And it's Joan, his wife. And she said, hi, Mike, it's Joan. And I know Joan. I was in their wedding. I've known 20-something years, you know. I know the family. We're involved in each other's lives. And it had eaten up his back to the point where his arms really weren't working anymore. She says, Brian would like to talk to you. I'm going to hold the phone for him. And I said, okay, Joan. And he's, you know, he said, Mike? And I, yeah. And he says, I just want to thank you for sponsoring me. And it takes my breath away. You know, it's in his back. Shit's not working. And I'm... just the gratitude. It was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. And so that's the one side of it. The other side of it is Dennis, whom I loved. I just loved this guy, and I sponsored him off and on for 25 years. And he got the gift. He got the gift. We were talking about the gift. He got it. He got the wife. He got the two beautiful little blonde girls. There's a certain kind of blonde that's got a special name. I forget what it is. The color of the blonde, I forget. But two beautiful little girls. Lovely wife. 5 years clean. And he used. And he used, and he came in, and he used, and he came in, and he used, and he came in, and on for 25 years. And I sponsored him several times throughout that. One of the times I sponsored him, I had about 20 years clean. And I thought, you know, I'm going to give it, we're going to do it this time. Because I didn't, you know, you learn how to sponsor. I became better and better at it. And I thought I was a rather good sponsor at that point. And so we got into it, man. I mean, we got into it. And the phone calls and the time and the investment and everything. And he got another 18 months and he used. And I was like, damn it, Dennis. You know, and every time he came back, he was obsessed with making up the damage he had done to those two little girls. And I'm seeing them, they're growing up incrementally, right? They're adults now, right? And he was just, he wanted to buy that back just as much as he could. And then he, you know, come into their lives and a little hope would happen and this and that. So I got that 18 months, used again, went down to South Florida treatment, got in and out, same thing. But he's a lovable, wonderful guy, man. I mean, it was so much fun. And he was hooked into the fellowship down there. And the final relapse he had, you know, he had gone through all kinds of different things and he just kept coming back. And at this point, his body just said, no. No more, no more, no more. And he's in the hospital, and he loses his sight, and he's so weak, you know, and I'm getting reports, and I'm on the other coast of Florida, and I decide I'm going to go over and see Dennis. And I go to the hospital, and I go to the room, and he's surrounded by local fellowship. He's surrounded by addicts. You know, and I have to announce myself because he can't see anymore. And I said, hey, Dennis, it's Mike. And he's, oh, Mike, come here and hug me. Mike. And they moved out of the way, the side of the bed, and I went down the side of the bed. He can't hug me. He can't lift up out of bed. And so I reached down, and I put my cheek against his cheek, and I press our cheeks together. You know, and he's saying wonderful things. You've been there for me. And I could feel his tears going down my cheek. Right? And I'm like, I love you, Jeff. I love you, you know. And he says, I'm scared. He's got that fear. He didn't have what Brian had. He didn't get that relationship with that higher power. He didn't get the 23 years of recovery, 24 or 5 years of recovery that Brian got in staying engaged in this thing. He had all those regrets. He never really, really got to amend those relationships with his daughters. You know? And the profound difference, when he said he was scared, you know, and I think he died the next day or the day after that. It was just... So, if I'm not here, if I don't keep coming, I'm not engaged in this process, in what we do here, and why we do it, and how we do it, I miss out on that. I don't get to participate in that. So do I have to keep coming to these meetings? I love coming to these meetings. When they say a new way to live, it's become a way of life. And so when I did that first step, I don't really have a lot of unmanageability. Nothing really gets to my life because of my network and the way I do recovery. If something's going on in my life, I'm talking to my sponsor or sponsees or one of you guys or girls. Or the women in my life are just incredible that I've met on this journey. And where I live now, sometimes I think they take it to the extreme, men with men and women with women. I understand the concept of that. But the ladies I've met in recovery, just incredible. Just incredible. And so, I just lost where I was. I'm sorry. Oh, I was talking about, so because all of you guys that I'm so engaged in my recovery, nothing gets to the point where I'm on my knees and I'm crying about the unmanageability of my life. It just doesn't get to that point, because when I'm talking to people every day, for me, it's like a pressure relief valve, right? I'm dealing with it right now, and I've become very sensitive to problems, to being uncomfortable. I don't like it. I'm a solution freak, man. I know there's a solution there. I want to get there. And not that I want, it's not going to magically work that the world, like, so I make a phone call and somebody gives me a suggestion and I take it. It doesn't magically make everything go away. Life is still life. The world is still there. But in my mind and in my heart, I know I've taken at least a half a step in the direction of solution. And I'm telling you, that's a game changer for me. It just is. So nothing gets to that point. And when I was writing that first step, and I've accepted my powerlessness, and it says we were powerless. And I've gained a great deal of power. You know, so it was really a wonderful experience going through my first step with 32 years clean, being passionate about what we do here. And I wasn't motivated because I was in pain. I want to continue on this process. I want to be engaged in this process. I want everything that I can get out of this, right? And so I'm really grateful to be here. I don't know how long I spoke, but thanks for the opportunity. I couldn't describe my life to you guys, but thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And again, the topic is Triangle of Self-Obsession. Our second speaker is Vickery.
Hey, my name is Vickery.
Hey,
Vickery. Hey, family. Clean. Oh, I hate that. clean by the grace of God, the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. A lot of help from a lot of people in this process. And a little bit of work of my own. And Mike V, I want to thank you. Amazing storyteller, just my opinion, right? you brought me to tears, partially because I can relate, and because I'm such a mushy, sensitive person these days. It's like, I don't even recognize myself sometimes, you know. But I want to thank the East Coast Convention for asking me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. It is always an honor and a privilege to be asked to share or to be of service to the fellowship. And so my definition of service has changed. It used to be I have a commitment what I'm real clear about now is that service is a posture of my heart, right? And so I'm very grateful. And emotional. You know, and I was like, really? Triangle of self-obsession? You know, but my God, you know, when I got here, I was an angry young lady. You know, I got here, I was 28. That's relatively young, right? I had a kid who was 10. I had a mom I hadn't talked to in many, many years. Not by my choice, you know, by her choice. You know, I was an unruly teenager and a kid that, you know, my mother's coping skills were that if loving you hurts too much, I just stop doing it, right? And so I lived with that and felt that for a long time. And so when I came into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I was hurting a whole lot. And I was a blame thrower too. So let me get that clear, you know. And resentments, you know, resentments, there's anger and fear, and then there's the opposite principles, you know, of acceptance, faith and love, and that it talks about how we are, like, somewhere along the line, my growth got stunted, like the IP talks about. I came in here and I was still like the little kid. I was like the 5-year-old that the IP talks about, like when they don't get their way. So I was a 28-year-old young woman that still threw tantrums and, you know, it's embarrassing to say that now. But I was like, I would still throw tantrums. I was very manipulative, you know. And I was hurting a lot, and I came in with all those issues, and it was all my mother's fault why I was a drug addict, you know. And what happened for me is that I had to start working on myself. You know, I came here, and I did a few things that weren't so healthy, and I looked up a day at a time, and I had a grand sponsor at the time that said, what are you going to do now? You've been clean. They used to tell us, you're zestfully clean, you know, so what are you going to do now, you know? And it was, I was like, I don't know, I just know that as long as I keep that thing out me, I'll be okay. At least that's what I thought. And I used to come to meetings and I would attend meetings and I would listen to members and they would say, you know, I remember going to a 6-step meeting one time and like they were laying out all their character defects. And it talks about in this pamphlet about how, you know, our defects stem from the fear, the anger, and the resentment, right? And so I was like, oh, those poor people, I'm so glad I don't have that issue. You know, because my denial was thick. That disease had me clutched and I didn't even know it. And so, but I really believe that, you know, and going back to that grand sponsor, they kind of got dug in me and was like, why don't you try to do some step work? And I was like, I didn't come here for all that. I didn't come here. You know, but what I did know, if I didn't know anything else, is that everything else I had tried did stop working or never did work. You know, I was the addict that they prayed over, took me down to the altar, I went to Bible study, I changed my friends, you know. I went to long-term treatment in Florida, I relapsed from there, you know, like, nothing ever worked. I moved around. You know, people that know me, any neighborhood in Baltimore, like, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, over on the west side. I'm like, oh, yeah, I lived there. Like, I've lived everywhere. I was the addict that did the geographical changing to try to fix myself. So I knew that whatever else I had done did not work. So I started embarking on the steps, you know. And thank God for that very first surrender. You know, my surrender date is March the 5th, 1999. And I don't share that to boast. I share that so that people know that we can come here and get clean and stay clean if you're new. You know, and if you're new, welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. You know, you're in the right place, I promise you. You can hold me to that, too. You know, but so I came in with all those issues. I had to start doing some step work. You know, I did the 1, 2, and 3, got a really firm foundation, and I got to step 4, and I got to the section on resentments. Well, I did not know that my resentment list was going to be that long. I did not know that I was a person that held. I started step 4 when I was about 30. I didn't know I was carrying like 25 years worth of resentment. I didn't know the very first one that I had was when I was 5. It started when I was 5 when little kids teased me when I went to school. And I didn't just get mad at those kids. What I realized is that I had gotten mad at a whole class of people based upon what those few kids did. So my resentments run deep, you know. And so I went on through that list. You know, my mom was at the top of that. I mentioned her. And, you know, by then I think I had not talked. I don't know how long it had been. I will tell you this. Through the program of Narcotics Anonymous, my mom and I talked for the first time after 17 years. So I don't know how long it had been when I did that. You know, I can't remember the exact dates. So my mom was on there, you know, and it's interesting how you come. So we talk about resentment, right? And let me just say this: so the three corners of the triangle, they can double team me, right? They can double team me, triple team me. Sometimes there's one of them that could be affecting me one at a time, you know. Sometimes it might be resentment and fear, you know, all at the same time. You know, so I'm writing through that resentment list, and I realize that, like, I am so resentful. Like, no wonder I was angry at the whole world, because I blame the whole world for everything that ever happened to me. And what I found out is that the real solution to that is really acceptance. You know, so I'm writing and I'm looking, and the patterns are being revealed to me through my step work that, in Vickery, it's not them, it's you. It's your unrealistic expectations that you place on people. And so what happened is it would set me up to be mad because you didn't act the way I thought you should act. It's all about me, right? You didn't act the way I thought you should act. You didn't do what I thought you should do. You didn't treat me the way I thought you should treat me. I compared you, my mom, to the little girl Jenny Stewart's mother down the street. Her mother made bologna sandwiches and cut them out with cookie cutters, and my mom didn't do that shit. You know, so I was like mad, you know, like, and that's real. Like, all that came out in my step work. So it was like, okay, so once I remember writing that, and I remember going through my step process with my sponsor at the time, and like just being able to accept my part. So the acceptance piece, right? And recovery is an active change in our ideas and our attitudes. I would say my perception. And so I remember coming out of my fifth step and it was like, oh my God. Like, I was like free as a bird. Real talk. Like, I was free as a bird because it was like I didn't have all those resentments with me anymore, because I was able to see my part in it and I was able to let it go. You know, I was able to accept the responsibility that I played in those things. Like, people don't have to do what you want them to do, Vickery. People don't have to act what you want them to act. Maybe you need to stop placing unrealistic expectations on the people in your life. You know, and what that really looks like is, so I grew up in a household with my mom and my dad. My dad was a traveling salesman. He did very well at his job. My mom was a practicing alcoholic. She drank a lot. And my dad would leave my mother home with four kids. And my mom would be pissed about it. You know, and she would drink a lot. And so I was a little girl that, like, needed some. I'm the youngest of four children. I was adopted. I'm the only one that looks like me, right, in my family. And, you know, my parents treated me the same as all the other kids, but what they didn't realize is that maybe I did need a little something different. And they didn't teach them that, you know. But I was so angry with my mom. Like, I just felt like she didn't understand, you know. She didn't know what she was doing. Well, come to find out through the step process and being open, I heard some stories that my mom, when she and I did start talking, I found out that she grew up in an alcoholic parent home too, two alcoholic parents, and that her parents owned a mortuary, and that that's a depressing business, and they drank to deal with the profession, and that my mom and her sister could never come home from school with friends because they never knew what they would walk in on. And so my mom would come in, and like maybe her mom, her I know she told me one time her dad had blackened her mother's eye, and her mother was passed out on the floor and they were drunk, and her mother had threw up on herself and was laying in her own, you know, vomit. And I said all that to say, so to combat or to break part of the triangle of self-obsession, right, for the resentment piece is that, wow, I was able to have a change in perspective. Like, my mother's one of us, you know. And just to be able to see that, you know, and the anger, and some of the anger that I had with her at that time, which I could talk about now, which I'll get to. You know, the opposite principle is love. And I want to venture off to say that I found, so love for me can also be tied to compassion. And so what happened is when I found out about my mom's childhood truth and how she grew up, a compassion rose up in me that I didn't know existed. you know, the girl that didn't care about anybody or anything but myself, I was able to look at my mother through the eyes, not looking at my mother and she was neglectful and she didn't do all, she didn't, the acceptance piece and the compassion double teamed me as well on the solution side of the problem and said, you know what, she's one of us and she can't give you what she doesn't have. She didn't have it. And so what I did, the unrealistic expectation went away because I stopped expecting her to give me what it is she didn't have to give me. And so the acceptance piece just resonated deep in my spirit and it was like I was better. You know, and I can't tell you when it happened. I just know I kept trusting the process. I kept trusting the God of my understanding. I kept talking and working with my sponsor, doing step work. You know, I kept coming here. And, you know, so that's one part of the triangle. And then we get over to the fear thing. And Lord knows when I did some step work, you know, thank God for step three that comes before four because our steps are written in order. You know, and then you get down to step seven and 11 and they're all about God and faith and, you know, and it was like, wow, because I needed that faith embarking and even looking at some of that stuff that I just shared with you all about. But so the part of the triangle of self-obsession, there's fear was huge. I looked at my fourth step and like fear was driving my entire life. Not only an active addiction, but when I first got here. One of the fears that I really, 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 and I still work on it, but I'm so much freer than I used to be, is the fear of what other people think about me, right? Inflated sense of self, like that raging self-obsession that you talked about, you know. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, keep coming. And if you don't struggle, thank God, because that was a self-made prison all in myself, you know. And so I wouldn't do certain things, I wouldn't say certain things. And it all stems back to childhood. Like, my mother was drinking and, you know, I got beat for simple mistakes. You know what I mean? When a five-year-old spills milk, I think you shouldn't beat him for it, right? It was an honest mistake, you know. But I would get beaten for it. And how that translated to me as an adult was that I didn't want to do anything because I didn't want to make a mistake and embarrass anybody, you know, much less myself, you know. And so that was a fear that was ingrained in me. You know, I also didn't want to, I had a fear of like everything. I had a fear of success. You know why? I wanted to fly right under the radar because the real Vickery really didn't want to grow up and be responsible. You know, it's like that five-year-old that our IP talks about how we depend on other people to take care of us. I was a grown woman in Narcotics Anonymous with like 10 years clean before I even realized that I still wanted everybody to take care of me. Like, I still really never wanted to take care of myself. You know, and so I can relate it all the way back to like being the youngest, being adopted, playing that card till it wore out. You know, you brought me here. I can't help it that I'm different. You know, the whole manipulation piece. And again, that stems back to my six-step defects. You know, and so I still wanted people to take care of me. And I'm going to go a little different direction. So part of practicing faith, I had my mom over here that I wasn't talking to. I had a dad that was trying to overcompensate, who was very codependent, that had a hard time telling me no. He was feeling bad and guilty because my mother wouldn't deal with me. It has put a wedge between their relationship, let me say that. And my dad, when I was in treatment many years ago in Florida, I did not know that when my father left treatment from like a family group session or whatever, because he had visited for that, when he left, they sent him to a place in Philadelphia for codependency treatment. So it was deep. And so part of my work in recovery was learning how to not ask my dad for anything. And it might not seem like a whole lot, but when you come in here and you're a grown up in your 30s, I mean, I think I got about 12 years clean and my dad came to one of my anniversaries and he said, I'm really proud of you. He said, you haven't asked me for one red cent since you got clean. And that might not mean a whole lot to anybody else, but for a little girl that never wanted to grow up that was spoiled, rotten, you know, enabled way beyond, I probably should have been dead. Like, you know, like all the stuff that I got, you know, that was unhealthy. But I had to do the work in that area and I had to practice what I call faith. Like, okay, you're going to be okay. And I would hear people share, and the members in here would say, you know, my mom died, and it would be like a mortality and a reality check. Like I would hear them share about how their mom was their safety net and that she wasn't always going to be there. And you guys might didn't know, but you all were helping me because I was listening, saying, you know what? If my mom and dad die before me, they're not always going to be here either. My dad's not always going to be here to take care of me. Vickery, you need to take care of yourself. And then it got even crazier because I wound up in a relationship with a man. And I remember we were together and we had made all these fantastic plans and we were engaged. And he lived in this little teeny house in this little teeny block. And I didn't envision that for myself. And we had made all these agreements about, you know, like, well, I'm going to, you know, and I lived there and I was making $40,000 a year. I had no bills. No bills, right? No bills. Who doesn't love that? Like, it wasn't a whole lot, but I didn't have any bills, you know. And I'm there, and we're in the little block, and I'm saying, I don't want to be in the little block. And what had happened is, so I had stopped asking my dad for stuff, but it translated over to the men that I was dating. And that man was allowing me to not pay any bills. And I looked up a day at a time, and like, I said, well, I thought we were going to rent this house and buy a nicer house. And he was 14 years older than me, consequently. Like my dad's older man, right? And I wind up in a service somewhere outside in our fellowship somewhere else. And I wind up there and I received this message. And I remember I came home that day and it was like I kept praying and praying. And God revealed to me, like, you still, now it's his fault why you're not where you think you should be in life. Because why? Because you're still wanting somebody else to take care of you, Vickery. Codependency was like, I was up to here, right? And so, and I was afraid. I was afraid. You know, fear was running all those decisions. And I called my sponsor, who's in here today, and I, you know, for various reasons, our lives weren't adding up, and I felt like I was putting a round peg into a square hole. And it had been a while. And I learned how to... She guided me and helped me learn how to leave a relationship amicably and respectfully. Not with green trash bags, not cussing you out, not making you into a monster so that I can be okay with my decision. Just saying, hey, this isn't working for me anymore. You know, and I had to practice some faith. I moved out of that house with that man and bought my first home, my only home. I've only owned one. Bought the home in that I live in now. You know, and I had to let that go and just trust that wherever I was going and have the faith that God, I was going to be okay regardless. And also in that relationship, so we talk about fear. How about, I can talk about another fear. So I faced the fear of being having to be responsible. I faced the fear of having to, you know, be afraid of success and failure. And then I got a fear, and this is a big one, I know some people can relate, a fear of being hurt. Because I did a separate fourth step up on relationships with men, and it started all the way back with my daddy, and I had to come all the way forward. And so I did that work in that area, and I found out that men represented two things to me, and this was years ago, y'all. I love y'all now. Love and respect. Love and respect. Don't get me wrong. I promise, right? But y'all represented ATM machines, and y'all represented pain. And that's a woman's scorn. If you ever hear a woman say, oh, I was the woman that would say, girl, all men are dogs. All of them cheat. You can't trust any of them. That, to me, is a sign of a woman's scorn. You know, and those were my experiences. And I would like to say I was a victim, but I volunteered for quite a bit of that. Let me be clear about that, right? And so I had to do some work in that area. And I remember that relationship, even though it didn't work out, the one thing I can tell you is that I learned how to have some faith. And what it looked like is, I remember I was working on a sixth step at the time, and I laid down on the floor, and I was praying, and I was crying, and I was saying, God, please. And I had just got off the phone with my sponsor, and I said, I don't know how he puts up with me. You know how I can always blame and say it's everybody else's fault? I said, I am not fit. I'm telling her, I am not fit to be in a relationship. I am crazy. I'm insecure. I'm fearful. Like, I have these crazy things I want to do to get my needs met. you know, my fear will drive me to, like, cause all this chaos and confusion, and if the dust settles and the man's crazy enough to stay there with me, then I get some kind of sense of, like, comfort, like security, like it's, and I was like, and so I was still doing some of those things, and I was able to see it, and I said, I don't know how he puts up with me. It's not about me putting up with his crazy stuff. It's about, how does he put up with me? And I was sick of myself. Like, our sixth step talks about becoming entirely ready. And so I get down on my, face down on my, I was face down in the living room on the carpet, and I did one of those snotting, crying, like, begging, pleading, God, please help me, change me, please help me be a better woman, help me be the woman you want me to be, help me to not be so afraid anymore, help me. And I remember I came up off that floor, and I don't care what anybody says, they don't have to believe it or not, it's my experience, is that there was a fundamental change that happened that day. It was a fundamental transformation that nobody could fix but the God of my understanding. And I was laying there and I was saying, and I came up off the floor and I realized that I had more value than what lied between my legs. That was one thing that I came up with. I came up with, like, realizing, like, you really want to love like you've never been hurt. And you can. And I came up believing in my heart, the faith came. Like, if you do get in another relationship, Vickery, and it doesn't work out, and the man hurts you or he cheats or whatever, I got you. You're going to be okay. I have brought you through active addiction. I have brought you into the room in Narcotics Anonymous. I don't know about anybody else, but the God of my understanding is a gentleman. He doesn't put me in places where he can't get me out of. He's not going to let me go in somewhere all by myself. You know, and so it was like, oh my gosh. And so now, the solution, you know, I'm kind of dating, but I've dated since then some other men. And I'll tell you what, if I didn't do anything else, I gave freely of myself. I was no longer afraid to be vulnerable. You know the old information, don't ever let him see you sweat. Don't let him know how much you care about him. He's going to take your kindness for weakness and all this crazy. I stopped doing all that. You know, I started putting my whole, and you know, I started like being able to not send the representative in. I was able to go in and just be myself. And if it wasn't good enough or wasn't what you liked, I was going to be okay. The last relationship I came out of a year and a half ago, it was the first time in my life that a man left me. I was always the one to leave because I was running scared. You know, and so I've been able to have the faith to like stick and stay, don't run. The minute they don't do what you want them to, you don't cuss them out, rip all your stuff up out the drawers, pack it up in a little grocery bag and take it home with you. You don't do that anymore, you know. I had to learn how to have the faith to withstand and be okay, you know. And so I've been able to do that, you know. So the last thing I want to talk about, you know, that's really on my heart is, for those of you that know, but I started off with saying that I hadn't talked to my mother in a long time, and through the step process and the eighth and the ninth step, and that's a whole workshop in itself, I was able to, how do I want to say that? I was able to meet my mother again. And even when I re-met her, I was angry for a while. And I will tell you right now today that I have a 31-year-old son. Is he 32? He's 32. Wait a minute. He's 32. That's what happens when you have kids young and you know. But he was 32. He's 32, and I have a granddaughter who's 8. And quiet as it's kept, I've got a grandbaby on the way. And, well, it's not quiet anymore. But... the vault. This is the vault. For those of you who were here earlier, this is the vault. And so my mom has not ever met my son face to face. She's never met her great granddaughter who's 8. And she may not meet the grandbaby that's on the way. And my sister always says, if she wrote me and Sean, who's my nephew, off, that would be enough for me to never speak to that BITCH again in life. And she has said it several times. And she says, I don't know how you do it. And I said, well, I have a 12-step program with amazing people and principles. And I got a relationship with this amazing higher power that gives me the strength to love and be who I am in spite of who other people are and what they do. And that I got to stay consistent and stay the course. And the consistency and state of course is a cute way of saying keep coming back. Like, just keep coming back. You don't quit. You know? And so I'm not angry. You would think that I am. Does it hurt? Am I hurt? Yes. Does it hurt on some days? Yes. Is it difficult? Yes. Fear had hit me in that area. So when my mom and I first started talking, she would have these family gatherings. And I would be sitting, I would come, like it would be a brunch at this restaurant with all her kids and her grandkids. And I would show up on two different occasions that stick out in my memory. I showed up and I was the only one there without my kid. My sister's there with her kid. My brothers are there with their two, they each have a boy and a girl. And, fear kept me from telling my son that it was even going on. And I found myself not sleeping well at night. And I was sharing with people and they said, that's your seed. And so we break the triangle of self-obsession. And I asked God for the courage and the faith. And I sat down and I told my son what had been going on. And then I called all my family members and put them on a gentle notice, because I do things differently today. I'm not doing that. That's not right. You know, I called up and put them on a gentle notice and said, you know, if Anthony's not invited, I won't be coming. Because my mom didn't talk to me forever. And that's one thing that I didn't like about her. And, you know, I find out the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But what the program of Narcotics Anonymous has done is given me a choice. I can choose to be different. It also gives me the ability to be able to break the triangle of self-obsession and unhealthy chains in our family. And so I was able to, like, just not do it anymore, and I don't, you know. And so it hurts that my mom doesn't know them, but it's more her loss than it is mine. My mom didn't talk to her mother when her mother died. Her mother wasn't talking to her mother when her mother died. And I made a promise that when I die, my son and I will have a good relationship. I've made a promise to God that that will not continue to happen. You know, so I continue to love my mother. In spite of and this is what I've also done. I've let my mom off the hook. I told y'all she has her past and all her history, her own history. But what I'm learning about that is that when I practice the principles of this program, that my life is so much better that way. It is better than I could ever believe. My sister still is like, I don't know how you do it. I said, because you don't know what you're looking at. I don't tell her that. Because she don't have a program. They don't know what principles and action look like. They don't know what spirituality necessarily looks like the way we do, you know, huh? So I continue to love my mother. She just got diagnosed with cancer. She's 83. She chose not to have any cancer, and I'm going to close because I know you gave me the time. She, this was January, you know, and I was like devastated. I got on my Zoom family, sponsor family meeting, and I boo-hooed and cried it out in the vault. And I did. I cried it out, and I talked about it. You know, and what's amazing is that when you break the triangle of self-obsession, you become less, it's less about me and more about other people. And you talked about that, Mike. And so what it looked like is, I'll never forget, and it wasn't even a second thought. My sister calls me one night, and my mom's a little cloudy at night, but she's very clear in the morning, you know. And she calls me up and says, well, what do you want to do? She's like giving me the whole diagnosis and prognosis and everything. And she said, what do you want to do? And it wasn't even a second thought. I responded and said to her, Mommy is still in her right frame of mind. I think we need to have a conversation with Mommy and find out what she wants to do. It wasn't about me and what I thought, you know. It was about really having the faith that whatever our mother chooses, we're all going to be okay. And I've been saying this a lot lately, and I know this is one of the principles of the program. I'm finding out that when I surrender, I don't always get what I want, but I get what is best for everyone involved. And, you know, and so that's really where I'm at. You know, I'm really grateful to be here. I want to thank everybody who was patient with me and listened. I want to thank Mike for a beautiful lead. You brought me to tears. You know, I could relate. I wasn't the sponsor, but I was the sponsee that called and said, thank you for sponsoring me. I was him. And so it brought me to tears because I could relate. I had 7 years clean, and I called and thanked my sponsor, who our first sponsor died from cancer. And I was able to thank her, you know, on my 7th year anniversary. And then my 8th year, she passed, you know. But thank you for sharing your experience and your intimate relationship with us. And again, I want to thank everybody for listening. And really, that's all I got. So thanks for letting me share.
All right, I want to thank Mike and Vickery again.
Yeah.
And we'll...